Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us today is Al Schaefer, the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, one of the nation's most experienced acquisition professionals. He started his career in the United States Air Force as a meteorologist and retired as a colonel. Al, always a pleasure having you on.
Thank you, Vago. It's glad to be here.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Al, from the very start of the pandemic, obviously the focus has been to use what is an unfortunate national tragedy as an opportunity to improve the organization, acquisition and otherwise. We've heard from Ms. Ellen Lord, your boss, about organizational changes, from speeding up contracts and increasing progress payment rates to awarding contracts more quickly, at the same time doing sort of structural changes. Let me just ask you, what are the parts of the changes you're enacting that are going to outlive the coronavirus ultimately to improve the acquisition enterprise?
So I think, Vago, it's a great question. I think we're still mulling through that, and we're going to have to go through lessons learned. Regrettably, I don't think we're through with the pandemic crisis right now. So, each day I get reports on the number of people across ANS who we have on quarantine, and we were down below 100 for a good bit of June, maybe May. We have since spiked back up to between 300 and 450 people on quarantine every day. So we're still in the midst of this, and we're still learning lessons. That said, I think we have learned a number of things from the pandemic. First, we need to have, and we're in the process of figuring out how to establish this, a singular office that prepares for contingencies. I am incredibly proud of the job that our team did, and I'm incredibly proud of the job the department did. But early in the pandemic, we were scrambling a lot to figure out who was going to be having wells. Everything. And of course, that gets complicated with the interagency process with FEMA and HHS. So I think we have to have some way of institutionalizing the cross-agency processes and figure out what type of organizational structure that we will have in place, basically as a contingency coordinator for acquisition. One of the biggest, I don't want to get into superlatives and everything, but I think one of the really strong actions that we took was by the end of March, establishing and standing up a joint acquisition task force. We put our most seasoned career SES, Ms. Stacy Cummings, in charge of that. And within a couple of weeks' time, she had a team of about 60 to 80 acquisition professionals coordinating everything that the department was buying for HHS and FEMA. And I think a lot of people don't realize that 90% of all government-purchased personal protective equipment, pharmaceuticals and everything is actually purchased by Defense Logistics Agency. So we had this enormous bow wave of things coming into DLA, which of course is an ANS unit, to just go out and do procurements for the nations. And we all learned all about N95 masks and ventilators and everything else that DLA surged to buy. But to date, DLA has purchased about $1.6 billion worth of equipment with somewhere in the order of 15,000 individual contract actions. And that's in about the 4 to 5 month period. So learning how to exercise that contingency response, I think, is a big thing. The second thing was, I think the pandemic got us to look at a lot of our FAR and DFAR rules, federal acquisition regulations or rules, and defense federal acquisition rules. As you mentioned, we did things like increase the rate for progress payment to get cash flow out. And to date, in total, we have issued on the order of 30 to 32 class deviations for contracting actions. We have to go back after this pandemic and figure out which of those were kind of, we got rid of old world bureaucracy and the world didn't come to an end. So I think a number of those, and I'm not going to get into specifics because we haven't done the analysis yet, but I think that this pandemic has reinforced on us that it's okay to look at some of the old bureaucracy and bureaucratic impediments. The third big lesson was how effective, once we got organized to handle the volume, how effective the Defense Production Act can be. So, you know, to date, we have issued over 31 Defense Production Act contracts. That's a lot for a program that had been kind of wandering along doing one, two, or three a year. So we, through the Defense Production Act and through our acquisition professionals, both in OSD and the services, have dramatically increased the capacity, the production capacity for N95 masks, for swabs, for test kits,
right,
for filter media, for all kinds of PPE. But we also use the Defense Production Act very effectively in some of our defense industrial base that was really hit hard as we went into this pandemic.
Let me ask you about, you know, you said that the caseload, Al, is getting worse. Where do you project the impact of this being on the defense industrial base and the ability of contractors to develop, deliver to your needs? Obviously, F-35 has experienced some delays. We've seen some delays on the AMP-V program that the Army has discussed. I know that the department is looking for anything from sort of $11 billion to $20 billion or so to cover coronavirus costs. Where do you think you're going to be on delivery delays, and where are you on talking to the Hill to get them to give you the money to reimburse your contractors with, because those are justifiably allowable costs at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think we're getting pretty pretty strong support from much of the Hill on recognizing that these are costs that have to be to paid. So I don't worry as much about the Hill. We're working the Hill very hard to make sure they understand our needs. Going back to your first question, I think we're not going to see the true impact of this pandemic probably for another 6 months to a year. So we've had the initial rush at peak, about 250 defense industrial base partners of DC, a defense contract management agency, and 500 from DLA were closed down. This caused fragilities in the supply chain going down 3, 4, 5 levels. And we're seeing some of that supply chain dry up. So I don't have an exact number, an exact figure. You quoted the around $10 billion number. That's in the ballpark. But we are going to see slowdowns in delivery. And we're working with the service acquisition execs and the primes to understand those and mitigate where we can.
Do you, let me ask one other Defense Production Act question. One of the concerns that exists is that the system, which is designed to be able to mobilize very quickly and in vast scale in an emergency, has been used somewhat sparingly. And then there are questions, for example, the recent award that went to Kodak is being accused of having cronyish dimensions to it. At the end of the day, what's the mechanism that's being used? You know, as you said, there's room for lessons learned and for improvement at the end of the day. From your standpoint, you know, are these awards competitive? What are the kind of expertise that are being brought to bear at the end of the day to make these decisions? Because I think we got a sense that the Pentagon was queued up and ready and waiting for the rest of government and the White House to sort of execute some of these decisions. Where are we and how are these decisions being made at the end of the day to make sure that the nation's industrial capacity is being harnessed adequately for the magnitude of the challenge at hand?
So great question, Vago. What I will do is I'll focus on our defense process and the defense industrial base. We had established, last fall, the Defense Industrial Base Council, which is made up of myself, our Assistant Secretary for Acquisition and Sustainment, and the service acquisition executives of each service. Through that Defense Industrial Base Council process, which we shifted to meet once a week, we had our teams go through and identify places in sectors in the industrial base that were in trouble. And maybe in trouble is a good word. And then we went out and got competitive bids for what people needed. And then corporately, as almost a board of directors, decided which ones would get the Defense Production Act funding for the industrial base. I will say to date, we had about just shy of $1 billion allocated to the DIB, and we have gotten all but about $80 million of that on contract. Other parts of the government had to learn how to process and execute Title III through us. We worked with them through Stacey Cummings' organization, and I think they've come up. At least HHS and FEMA have learned how to use the process to start to get equipment flowing. But there is a learning process in there.
And is there competition in this? Or are you guys at DOD sort of executing what it is that other parts of the government want to do? I mean, how does the mechanism itself work, which is, I think, a question that some folks are asking now.
So I will speak for the Defense Industrial Base stuff under the Defense Industrial Base Council. We identify a sector where we believe we have a fragile supply chain. And if we're down to one vendor who's hurting, that's probably not competitive, but we have a due diligence process where we understand why that particular vendor is having problems. In other cases, like commercial aviation, we actually did go out, not in the standard bid and proposal, but we did ask for white papers from each of the potential vendors and evaluated that those proposals. So I would say it's a mix. I would prefer not to speak on how other government agencies determine what needed right. to be funded with Title III and not. But we try to do diligence, and we do go through, fortunately, I can say very, very carefully, very clearly, everything we do is completely legal, and lawyers check us every step of the way.
Let me ask you about the ANS, Acquisition and Sustainment Organization, and how it's interacting with research and engineering. Obviously, that was an acquisition reform to split the old Office of Acquisition Technology and Logistics in two. That was a brutal process that involved clashes of personality and turf. It extended into office size and office location. There was a little bit of contentiousness about that. At the end of the day, now that we're a couple of years into this, Al, as somebody who was a former Director of Defense Research and Engineering, as somebody who was the U.S. Armaments Rep in Europe, where are we now about how to structure, you know, as somebody who's been on the acquisition as well as on the engineering side of things, what's the right way, or are you at the right place now going forward to make sure that the organization itself operates as efficiently and effectively as possible?
Yeah, Vago, so there are so many layers to that question. What I will say first and foremost is we are following the law with the two organizations. We are learning how to better work with each other to make sure that as research and engineering develops great new ideas, those programs would be sustainable. I will be very, very forthright and say when I was the R&E, which was part of AT&L at the time, it was much easier because we were all in the same organization. So we've had to learn how to do things that almost came second nature previously. A lot of it is personality driven, as you say. We're very fortunate now because the people who are now in R&E, I go back with a long way. So I've worked with Mark Lewis for 20 years. And Sandy Magnus is wonderful. So it's really a matter of having people who want to be partners. I think that things are progressing very well right now. And we're working with R&E. I know you're interested in hypersonics. We're working with R&E to try to get a sustainable hypersonics program. So we've had to relearn lessons. We've had to make new lessons. We've had to overcome bureaucratic and territorial inertia. But I think we're in a much better place than when I got here 2 years ago.
And it sounds like, having talked to Mark Lewis and Jim Face, and hopefully we're going to talk to Sandra soon. It appears that that everybody's now getting into a bit of a battle rhythm, which is welcome to see given the urgency of the task at hand. Ms. Lord, and you and everybody associated with the DoD enterprise, stemming from Dr. Esperon down, have been talking about the need to move more quickly, to be more agile, especially when you're looking at an adversary like China that has access, or potential adversary like China that has such a vast span of technological capability and is fielding systems quickly. Talk to us about some of the fundamental things that your enterprise is doing to get to the speed question, to field capability, useful capability more quickly. Hypersonics being a great example of that.
Sure. So after the breakup, Kevin Fahey, who's our Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, was given the task of putting in all new policy directives under something called the Agile Acquisition Framework. So we are working with some of the authorities we got in Congress, Section 804, to do five-year prototypes. And we're trying to break programs down into smaller chunks. That's the way industry does it. We fought very hard to get an Agile Acquisition Software pilot, which is in its first year now. So we have, Kevin and his team have worked very hard to bring what I would call industrial best practices into how we're buying things in the department. So speed is of the essence, and whether you call China an adversary or a potential adversary, they have a very, very short acquisition timeline. So we're going to more prototypes, learn what we can from the prototypes, enter a program, a formal program at Milestone B with a very short engineering, manufacture, and development process, and move straight into procurement. We're also finding as we prototype more, we do a much better job with cost and schedule estimation, which of course allows us to field more quickly.
One of the other mechanisms that everybody has been using is other transaction authorities, OTAs. There is a concern, though, that OTAs are being overused and that oversight then becomes a problem, especially in a universe where the services have greater acquisition authority than they ever had, right? I mean, some folks find it problematic that developing your next generation attack helicopter would happen not through the normal acquisition system, but through an OTA. Talk to us about how you're maintaining some sort of oversight and control to make sure that all of these efforts to do things quickly don't actually end up backfiring on you and costing you enormous amounts of money in the process.
So I think there's a couple of answers there. But most importantly, we are reviewing, especially for major programs like Future Vertical Lift, We have stood up a board with the Army because the Army is using other transactions for a future vertical lift to make sure it is structured properly. You know, OTAs are a great vehicle when you're doing small, short technology development prototypes. They're not a great way to buy major systems, as I remind my Army friends, like they tried to do with former combat system, otherwise known as future combat system. you know, the former combat system was basically an OTA experiment that failed, and we lost a lot of authorities for years. We are making sure, to the best of our ability, that no major acquisition goes through an OTA without very, very careful oversight, and that would only be for the prototype stage. So if you look at future vertical lift, we are still at the process of that program where we're building two competitive prototypes, and we're building those in a short 4-year time window to evaluate, to mature technology and evaluate which concept is going to work best. I do not believe there's any plan at all to use an OTA for final development and procurement.
Do you think you have devolved a lot of authority? I know that Ms. Lord has been very proud, and I know you've talked about how few programs that OSD is overseeing at a senior level, the F-35 obviously being one of them, because it is a very important and a cross-cutting program. What are the ways that you guys are also exerting oversight over how the system, how each of the services is doing their roles? Because that was obviously required a little bit of learning as well, right? Because DoD did cede and return a lot of authority that it historically had back to the military services. So how are you guys getting that balance right between, you know, oversight, but also allowing the services to execute their own programs with the aim of delivering capability more quickly?
I think we're still in a learning process on that, Vago, but what I will tell you is each month for every ACAT-1 major acquisition program, we have a series of metrics for each individual program that the services have to report, and we track the performance over time. So we don't get involved until there's a problem. And the way we get involved is to say, go to the service acquisition exec and say, what's going on, and what can we do to provide you more help to get your program back on track? So it's through a much greater use of metrics. By the way, those metrics are briefed once a month to the secretary, and during in his secretary weekly priority review. So we still do have a lot of visibility on the individual programs. We're just not bogging down in the old Defense Acquisition Board DABs and things like that, that took a lot of time. So we're trying to focus on program progressing through milestones at cost and at schedule. And if there's no problem, we shouldn't get involved.
So how do you think you're doing on cost and schedule at this point? What are sort of the broader metrics? How are you guys performing? And what are the metrics you're using to determine how you're doing, right? Because if you can't measure it, it's hard to tell where you are.
So the easy ones are cost and schedule performance against milestone B and milestone C estimates. And we do track against milestone B and C. How are we doing for schedule points and cost points? And over time, and I attribute a lot of this to enhanced training at Defense Acquisition University. Over time, our performance has gone way up with regard to delivering a program at cost, at projected cost, and on schedule. Now, the cynic would say, is that because we're estimating higher program costs? I don't think so. I think we've gotten better at costing and evaluating schedule, that's what we're measuring against.
Let me ask about the Navy. Although almost all programs that were in your basket have now gone back to the military services. The 30-year Navy's 30-year shipbuilding plan and integrated force structure assessment have been pulled up to the OSD level. That's come up in congressional testimony as well, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it. What are you, as one of the senior most people in OSD who's looking at this, I mean, what do you want to see from the Navy? What does the Navy have to do for it to regain custody of one of its most important planning documents at the end of the day?
That wasn't pulled up by ANS. That was pulled up by other people in OSD. What we work with Hondo Gertz, the Navy acquisition exec, who I think is one of the best acquisition execs I've worked with. And we track against schedule and cost performance. The rest of it in terms of, you know, 355 ship Navy or what have you, I'll let other people talk to that.
The department has been working on a whole series of leap ahead capabilities, given the nature of the threats facing the nation. The challenge in any of these cases is how you successfully transition that with speed and scale for delivery. As somebody who's done both sides of this job, as well as worn the uniform that's used the capability that comes out of the system, from your standpoint, what are the key factors to bear in mind to drive that technology, but be able to produce it as affordably as possible at scale with speed?
Bago, I'm going to go off script on this answer, because I think nobody, I think no country in the world does a better job developing, acquiring advanced platform capability. So I'm going to instead answer what keeps me awake at night and where we have to do some improvement. And I think we have to continue to stress protection of our platforms and our networks against cyber intrusion. So we, you know, we do a great job in the kinetic space. It's our goal to make sure we do as dominant a job in cyberspace. And, you know, I don't want to ever field a system that costs $1,000 or $100 million that can be rendered ineffective by an adversary cyber attack. So I think that's really where we're coming around to. That's where I'm coming around to. How do we think about the new threats and how they will impact what we normally buy? And I probably just opened up a can of worms. Maybe that's a good talk for a future time. But we have to think about unconventional threats and how that can change us from where we are.
Let me pull on that thread briefly, though. One of the key priorities that the organization has had, and Katie Arrington has been head of the CMMC process, there has been a little bit of criticism that you're certifying certifiers at the end of the day, right? You're trying to turn this into a little bit of a home inspection model. And there are those who say that as a first step that works. Talk to us about where you want to get to, right? Because the degree of security you're talking about isn't just a certification challenge. You're, having discussed this with you, right? You're looking for a mindset change as you engineer and develop these systems so that it's not just an applique solution at the end of it. It's a engineered and designed element of it. So how do we go? How is CMMC sort of a milestone in getting to that much more secure system that you envision?
So Vago, I'll give you a very short answer because I had people ganging up outside my office, and I'm getting my military assistant, who used to be the commander of the old guard, so he's in really good shape and he's tough and mean. So he's giving me the eyeball. What I will say, a CMMC is a step along a pathway. It's a good step. It won't solve the entire problem. But at the end of the day, we have to make thinking about cyber protection part of everything we do so we quit losing intellectual property due to some particular adversary borrowing our intellectual property through cyber means. And we've got to make sure that our platforms operate as we design and expect them to. And both of those are very large challenges for the future.
Sir, thanks very much as always. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on to dive a little bit more deeply into all of this. Know how busy you are and really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Margo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.